Whoo-wee, are you tired yet? Is it exhausting? Well, yes, dear students, there's a lot for us to learn here, and we're at our final presentation for our Introductions to Stocks module. And so we have a little bit of odds and ends here. We're going to discuss the various types of stocks and market capitalization, and then take a look at some stock strategies. Is that a deal? Okay. So this presentation right here, this part of the presentation, is basically stolen from a book called One Up on Wall Street. It's not just from there, but Peter Lynch wrote a wonderful book called One Up on Wall Street. It's one of the first books that you should read when it comes to stocks. If it were up to me, it would be the textbook that we use, but it's not up to me. So he described various types of stocks. Now, I've added a few. I've played around with it a little bit and gotten from other places, but you really want to read this book eventually. It's one of the first books you should read. Another excellent first book is called Random Walk Down Wall Street, and we'll talk about that, and then you eventually want to read The Intelligent Investor. So all that stuff's on the website in a bibliography called Books to Read, and there's a commentary about that. So let's get started on slide 75. The types of common stocks. So these are the ones I want you to memorize. These are the broadest categories, and the most important stocks with regard to what's going on in the world are blue chips. These are financially strong, high quality stocks with long and stable records of earnings and dividends. Some people refer to them as value stocks, but we have to be careful when we use that term because it means different things to different people. They attract conservative investors. And then we're not talking politics, folks. These are people who don't want to lose a lot of money. You're going to lose, folks. There's going to be times when you're going to lose money. But on the whole, these stalwart is the word that Peter Lynch uses. These stalwarts are going to hold tough because they have their roots deep in the economy. And when the organic matter hits the ventilating device, they will hold up better than other companies. So let's take a look at some examples. General Electric, General Motors. Yes, for decades, General Motors was the biggest company with regard to revenue. And then they started getting hit on bad times. And throughout the early 2000s, up until 2006 and 2007, I was looking at them saying, yo, this company's going bankrupt. And other people were saying the same thing. And the CEO, I forget his name, was saying, no, we're not going bankrupt. You know, we don't want to hear this word. And then when the Great Recession hit, they went bankrupt. So General Motors of today is not the same General Motors of yesterday. And one could say that the new GM is a blue chip stock. Yes, yes, one could say that. But who are we talking about? Walmart, Home Depot in the retail world, Johnson & Johnson, 3M, Minnesota Mining and Materials. You know them as the company that makes Post-it notes. These companies, brand name companies that have been around for decades, Procter & Gamble and the like. And so these are companies that aren't going to make you rich overnight, dear students, but they also aren't going to disappear into a pool of tears. Although sometimes they do, like GM in the 2000s, you might have heard of Kodak. That was a stalwart for decades until this is the irony. They're the ones who created the digital camera, right? They used to sell film. Now, income stocks. Income stocks are companies, sometimes they're blue chips, sometimes they're not, but income stocks are stocks that have long and sustained records of paying higher than average dividends. Again, be careful. Some people refer to them as value stocks. They are normally slow growth companies in mature industries. So examples of this are utilities, right? Are utilities exploding on the upside with 20% growth? No. But are they going to fall and, you know, unless people decide they're going to start taking cold showers in the dark and eating raw food? Banks. For decades, banks were mature income companies until deregulation started to take hold in the 1980s, 1990s, and the 2000s, and then they got exciting, and then the wheels fell off when it turned out that, you know, it's not such a great idea to let your banks, who are the foundation, they are the foundation of the modern economy, to play with depositors' money in ways that could all vaporize. And there is still some of this hanky-panky going on, but at least they've, well, that's a whole different discussion. But income stocks, think of utility companies, railroad companies, companies that are reliable, that pay dividends for decades. Now, the next category are the growth stocks. Yippee! These are the companies with their picture on the cover of GQ and Vanity Unfair and Vogue magazine, and they've got the gorgeous hair and the sparkling teeth and pecs, you know, the six-pack. These are stocks that experience high rates of growth in operations and earnings. Everyone's talking about them, 15 to 20% growth. That might not sound like a lot, but if you're growing at 20% in 3 years, you'll be twice as large as you are now. Associated with high P.E. ratios. Remember the price-to-earnings ratio? Yes. Often no dividends at all or a very small token amount. Why? Because the profits are being reinvested back into the company. Right, right. They need that money not to pay dividends, but to grow the company. So the stock price should go up, but usually it's going to be very volatile because at the slightest hint of the growth slowing down, those growth momentum investors are going to sell the shares. They don't look at the first derivative. They look at the second derivative. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, if you're not into physics or math, then ignore what I just said. They don't look at the rate of growth. They look at the rate of the growth of the growth. Forget it. That's a math joke. Some examples. Intel, Microsoft, Hewlett. Wait a minute! Are Intel, Microsoft, and Hewlett-Packard still growth companies? No, that was 20 years ago. They've become mature companies that are paying excellent dividends. Right, who are the growth companies now? Right, yes, Farsbook and Titter and ClapSnapTrap, whatever. Social diseases. I'm sorry, social media companies. And Google and Apple, which is still hugely growing because everybody wants an iPhone, because if you have an Android, well, then you're just not anyone. Yes. These are the companies with the gorgeous hair, and everybody loves them. But careful! Right, they're going to be more volatile. Slide number 77. Now, we have to attack these two terms, growth and value. The investment world loves to use the terms growth and value. But be careful, dear students, because the meanings of the terms are not exact. It depends on who you're talking to. Typically, investors often use growth to designate a high price-to-earnings stock, while they use value to denote a low price-to-earnings stock. But those are not the ways I want to look at growth and value. When I use, especially the word value, when I see value, it means to me there's something worthwhile there. There's something interesting. In fact, that's what you'll hear some investors say. They don't use the word value. They say it looks enticing or interesting. Yes, it looks like something we want to investigate. And as a perfect example of this, folks, was Google and GM back in 2005. Google went public in 2004, August, and it promptly doubled in value. And this was January 2005. Google was selling for around $200 with a sky-high PE. I think it was 70, 67 or something like that. The old GM was selling for $34 with a PE of 6. It was very low, and they were paying out a very generous dividend. But, folks, it did not look good for GM, and I wasn't the only one who said this. I kept saying, you know, GM, I don't know what's going to happen, because they couldn't make any money selling cars. They were only making money selling SUVs and trucks. That's not a very, that was very scary. Right, exactly. And sure enough, exactly. Right. Google sells for, I don't know, it's like a $900 and some $1,000, $1,800 split adjusted, because remember, they dropped the price in half, but they doubled the number of shares. So it's around $1,800, $1,900. And the old GM stock, which was renamed Motors Liquidation, they first called it Liquidation Motors, but General Motors didn't like that. They said it sounds too much like General Motors, so they changed the name to Motors Liquidation. That last sold for 4 cents in March of 2011, and now it's worthless. So which one was the better value, dear students? You know, Google, obviously, but it had a high PE. So some investors will say, well, that's not a value stock. Well, be careful. As we said, some investors use value to mean a low PE stock, but a low PE stock might not be a good value, and a high PE stock might be a very good value. So you have to be careful. You have to identify how the person you're talking to, or the writer or whatever, is describing, is using these terms, growth and value. Slide 77. I mean, sorry, 78. Speculative stocks. Now, dear students, we're all enticed and tempted by companies that are skyrocketing. Everybody wants to jump on the bandwagon. Well, folks, these are companies with a very high risk of just becoming worthless or losing a tremendous amount of their value. These are typically companies that are money losing operations. They haven't generated a profit yet, or very low earnings relative to their valuation. They offer the possibility of substantial capital gains, folks. Yes, indeed. Momentum investors will say the trend is your friend. Ride it up and then get out before everybody jumps out. That's a little dangerous in my humble opinion. But more likely for us, substantial capital losses. It's the old saying that lambs to slaughter, right? They're leading the lambs to slaughter. Biotechnology, internet, alternative fuels, marijuana stocks, which are, this stuff is still illegal at the federal level, folks. Give me a break. Anybody ready to buy Tesla stock? Look, I'm not trying to badmouth Tesla, folks. I am in love with this company. I don't own their stock, but they are changing the world, and they're doing it in a way that nobody believed would ever happen 10 years ago. In fact, the guy who runs Tesla said he didn't care if Tesla worked or not. He didn't really care. He wants it to, but more importantly, he wants the world to change to electric cars, and now you hear every single manufacturer is coming out with electric cars. You hear government saying we don't want fossil fuels by 2040 or 2050. So he's changing the world, but the stock is outrageously expensive. Outrageously expensive. If everything goes perfectly for Tesla, which is hard to believe it will, yeah, maybe it's worth that, but I don't think so. And it won't. Everything won't go perfectly. So we're going to see what happens. I'm rooting for him, but I'm not. I'm staying away from his stock. Before you do invest in Tesla, I want you to take a look at GoBroke. I'm sorry. GoPro, right? And see what happened to another can't-lose stock. Oh, my goodness. And it gives us yet another opportunity, dear students, to remind you of what Mr. Benjamin Graham said decades ago. An investment operation is one which, upon thorough analysis, promises safety of principal and a satisfactory return. Operations not meeting these requirements are speculative. Hey, that doesn't mean you shouldn't invest in one of these or two of these, but for every one of these you invest in five Johnson & Johnsons or six 3Ms, all right? FedExes. Yeah, okay, good. Slide 79, cyclical companies. What? These are companies that are round? No. Cyclical companies are stocks whose earnings and overall market performance are closely linked to the general state of the economy. They follow the business cycle of advances and declines. The poster child for this type of company, cyclicals, are automobiles. Right. Automobiles are they just it's like a mirror. They just follow the business cycle. When the economy's doing well, income is going up, people have jobs, what do? They go out and buy a new car. What's wrong with the old car? I don't know. I want a new car. I like that new car smell. It's good for your lungs and your brain cells and liver. And when the economy's not doing well, right, exactly. Do they buy a new car? Oh, no. Old Bessie's doing just fine. And so we watch the economy to see how well automobiles are doing and vice versa. And it turns out that any company that makes materials, timber, steel, chemicals, and now chips, right? The chip companies have become cyclical because when everything is built, it all, everything new, everything in your shoes, everything has a chip in it. And, so they are now become cyclical companies. They used to be growth companies, but now they're cyclical. On the other side of the coin of are defensive stocks. Now, we're not talking about defense companies. Those are companies that make airplanes and bullets and tanks and stuff. No, and ships, battleships, but defensive stocks. Defensive stocks are stocks that hold their value and sometimes even do well when the economy starts to falter. They remain stable during declines in the market. And they're often associated, but not always, with income stocks. So who are we talking about? Food companies. Consumer products. Kellogg's, Procter & Gamble. Drug companies. Do you take more insulin because the economy's doing well? Do you take less insulin because you take your insulin because your doctor tells you to take your insulin. And so drug companies tend to follow the business cycle, although they have their own little cycles with regard to the life cycle of individual drugs. But still, people need antibiotics, they need statins, they need whatever, they need their pills, and they need your Cheerios. Do you eat more Cheerios because the economy is doing well? Do you eat fewer Cheerios? No, you eat. And so these are defensive stocks. And why do they do well when the economy starts to falter? Well, the momentum investors, the speculators, the traders will trade out of the cyclical stocks, out of the growth stocks, into the defensive stocks when the economy starts to falter because they know they will hold up better. So that will raise the price. And then when the economy is doing well, the defensive stocks sort of sit by the sidelines. Oh, we're still here. Don't worry. We're not going anywhere. You got make sense? Makes sense. So think about that. What companies are defensive? What companies hold their value even when the economy falters? Slide 80. Now, a few that are not as important, and you come across these every once in a while, turnaround stocks. I call them goners. Turnaround. These are companies that have fallen on hard times. And what you have to ask yourself as a potential long-term investor, is there a potential for a rebound? In the early 1980s, Chrysler almost disappeared, folks. And a gentleman by the name of Lee Iacocca came in and did a fabulous job of resurrecting the company. And now the three auto manufacturers are another example of turnaround companies that have turned around. It looks like Ford and GM are actually doing pretty good. Chrysler still around with us, but they've teamed up with Fiat. Figure that one out. And now China, a Chinese company, wants to buy Jeep. I wouldn't let go of Jeep, but they're only... Anyway, I'm not an auto analyst. But see, that's the thing with a turnaround. Because it might look enticing, folks, but usually they don't turn around. Kodak, yeah. Usually they are goners. Now, asset plays are a little interesting. Asset plays are companies that are sitting on an asset that could be sold or spun off if there's a trouble, or maybe it's generating a lot of income that people don't really understand. And the example I'm using here is JCPenney's. We all know JCPenney's as the retail and retail folks, they're really having a hard time. Macy's, JCPenney's, the Target, they're getting hit from below by the Amazons and the Walmarts, and they're getting hit from above by the boutique stores. So it's really tough for them now. And people are saying, I don't know about Sears. I mean, I think they're already on the path to destruction. But they're saying Macy's, JCPenney's, it's only a matter of time. I don't know. But they have an insurance company that is very profitable. They're the company that sells you baby insurance, which is stupid. Nobody depends upon the baby for income, but they're selling you life insurance for babies, and they're making a ton of money doing it. So if they had to, they could sell that to raise enough cash to keep the company afloat. And then penny stocks. Oh, folks, anybody tells you, oh, I made a ton of money. It's like gambling. Stay away from it. You're going to lose. And we have examples that we would show in the face-to-face class. They're on the website. They're in Canvas. Just stay away. These are sold where? On the OTC markets, the pink sheets, the bulletin board. Most all of these 20-some thousand companies are scams. You've heard of Butterfly.com or Flim Flam Incorporated, folks? They make blue steam. Right, yeah. It's going to do better than last year's left-handed smoke shifters. We guarantee it. And here, buy it for 5 cents, and look, it went up to 10 cents, and look, it went up to 15%. Look at the spread. Yeah, they'll buy it back for you. They'll buy it back from you at 4 cents. And then after they get it up to 25 cents, they disappear, and now nobody's buying except for you, and now you're trying to sell your shares, and everybody's gone. So just stay away from the penny stocks, okay? And lastly, our foreign stocks, international stocks. Well, these are a little difficult to invest in, folks. It used to be almost impossible, but now most all brokerage firms have international brokerage accounts, which means that you can keep not only dollars in your account, but pesos and yens and euros, and be able to buy and sell on other exchanges around the world. But most all of us will buy our foreign stocks through global and international mutual funds. Why? Because it's just a hell of a lot easier. There's not as much information about global companies. You're flying more in the dark. Unless you go with a company like Michelin or Nestle's or, you know, the Toyota. Well, Toyota, see, here's the cool thing. If you want to invest in a company that has been brought to the United States through what are called American depository receipts, sometimes you'll see GDR, you see ADR, you'll see GDR, which stands for Global Depository Receipts, or you just see DR, Depository Receipts. So if you want to invest in a company like Toyota or Honda, piece of cake. Why? Because what happened? A huge trust company or bank on Wall Street went over to Japan, bought a ton of shares of Toyota, brought them to the United States, and reissued them in dollar-denominated form so that you can buy your Toyota stock in the United States. But that's very few companies. They're the very large companies. But, you know, I've often wondered why they haven't done it with Nestle, which is based in Switzerland and is the world's largest food company, and Michelin, which is based in France and is the world's largest tire manufacturer. So I don't understand those. But so ADRs, GDRs, you can get lots of information and you know what you're dealing with. But most other companies, I would stay away from it. And also, you have to think of the currency issues. Just think about them, because I wouldn't try to speculate in these, but some people will. Because what happens, folks? Well, the currency is a very important issue when you invest outside the United States. What happens if the dollar strengthens? Well, your foreign investments, all other things being equal, and they never are, are now worth less. Right. How did that happen? Well, think about it, folks. You bought a house in Mexico, for example, for $100,000. Now the dollar strengthens. Well, your house is now worth less because when you sell it in pesos, I forgot to say, you changed into pesos, changed your dollars into pesos, and you bought the house, which was worth whatever the $100,000 was worth at the time in pesos. And now the dollar strengthens. So now if you sell the house in pesos, you're going to get, whatever the pesos are worth, and then you have to convert them back into dollars. Well, now it takes more pesos to pay to buy the dollars. You think about it. And the same thing is true on the other side. If the dollar weakens, Now those pesos buy more dollars, so if you sold the house, you would get more dollars. So a stronger dollar has a negative impact, and a weaker dollar has a positive impact on your foreign investments. But the reality is if these things tend to wash out over the long period of time, so you really don't have to worry. But the question is, will the dollar be stronger or weaker in the coming years? And it's my personal opinion that the dollar right now is pretty darn strong, and I'm thinking it's going to weaken over the next few years, but that doesn't mean I'm right, and I don't make my decisions based on that. I try to buy companies that I think are good for the long term, and my global investments, I do that through mutual funds, so I let the currency issues wash out, assuming that the world isn't going to end, and if it does, it doesn't matter. Slide number 82. Okay, so those were the different types of stocks, and you're going to use those stocks in the Chapter 5 assignment. When you research a stock, you're going to find all the information on the internet, and then the very last column will be what type of stock it is, and you use one of those types of stocks. And maybe there's one company might be two different types of stocks, or three. Sometimes companies don't fit in any category. So do your best. Don't worry about being perfect. Just do your best. Slide 82. A very, very important market statistic: capitalization. What is market capitalization? Well, it's a fancy word for saying how much the company is worth. What happens, people, is that people will focus on the price of the stock. They will focus on the price of the stock, and they'll not worry about the capitalization. This is a big mistake. So you don't know how much the company is worth until you multiply that stock price times the number of shares outstanding. It's a very simple calculation. It's done for you. We're going to do it in worksheet number 3, but it's easy. You take the price of the stock, and you times it by the number of shares outstanding, and that's another number that's readily available out there. And it turns out there are three categories: the papa bears, the mama bears, and the baby bears. And there's a couple of subcategories, but large cap, mid cap, small cap. And sometimes you'll see large dash cap or mid dash. They'll put a hyphen in between the two, but sometimes not. And the numbers change over time, but now you're looking at large cap companies that are $10 billion and up of market capitalization. So you multiply the share price times the number of shares outstanding, and you get anything above $10 billion. That's a large cap company. You hear people starting to say, well, actually $15 billion. The numbers change over time. But let's just use $10 billion in this class. Then anything above $100 billion, and there aren't too many companies in this category, is called mega cap. If you remember that, great. If you don't, no big deal. But that's a subcategory of large cap companies. If you remember it, great. If you don't, no big deal. Mid-cap companies are anywhere between $2 billion and $10 billion. Again, you're starting to hear people say, oh no, you have to be at least $4 or $5 billion up to $15 billion. But for this class, don't worry, we'll use $2 to $10 billion. And then small-cap companies are anything between $100 million and $2 billion or so. Those are the small companies. You haven't heard most of them. And it sounds like a lot of money, $100 million, but in the publicly traded company world, that's a tiny company. And there's a subcategory. Anything when you get below $100 million, you're in a subcategory called microcap. And these are very tiny companies, folks, most of which you've never heard of. Many of them are never going to become large cap, but eventually, folks, every company was small at one time, right? So, well, not always. Some of the newer companies that are coming public are already huge before they go public, so they are not, they never have a chance to be small cap or mid cap. They are already large, which means the vulture capitalists, the insiders, have already made all the money, and now we're left to decide whether or not it's going to continue to be a decent company. So those are the three major. We want you to remember them. And if you remember the subcategory mega cap, and if you remember the subcategory of small cap called micro cap, that's great. If you don't, no big deal. Penny stocks. We shouldn't even discuss these with the other three. We should just look at penny stocks as something to be derided, to stay away from, because they are just scams. Okay? Enough said. Here's an example. Slide 83. The price of the stock is $20. If there are 5 million shares out there, we take $20 times 5 million and get 100 million. This is a small cap stock, even though it sounds, you know, that $100 million is a lot of money. No, not in publicly traded companies. The stock price, for the most part, dear students, is irrelevant until you get into the penny stock world. You must look at the market capitalization to see what the value of the company is. Remember Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway? He refused to split the stock? Exactly. Don't look at the price of the stock. Look at the market capitalization. Now, slide 84. So there's a worksheet number 3, that you're going to do, where you will do some calculations and decide what type of company it is, large cap, small cap, mid cap, and the like. Slide 84. Let's take a look at some examples. Walmart and Target. Now, you look at the price as of the 8th of September 2017, and it looks like Walmart's, you know, $79, Target's $57. You know, Target's a little smaller than Walmart. No. No, Target is much smaller than Walmart. It's something intuitively you understand. So let's take a look at how many shares are outstanding. There are 3 billion shares of Walmart, almost, and a little over 500 million shares, or one-sixth the number of shares. So the price, the market capitalization, the price times the number of shares outstanding of Walmart is over $200 billion, folks. Where Target's a big company, $31 billion, but still, it's, you know what, 1/7 the size of Walmart. What does this mean, folks? $235.6 billion. So if you wanted to buy Walmart, if you wanted to own that company, you'd need $235.6 billion and walk on down to the New York Stock Exchange. It doesn't work that way, but still, yeah, you'd need a ton of money. No one's gonna buy Walmart. But that's how much Walmart is worth. And when a company takes over another company, they've got to raise that capital. They've got to raise the amount of money. And in fact, they have to raise a little bit more. And there's a reason why. If you started buying up all the shares that were for sale, the price would start going up and up and up and up. And people would go, what's going on? There's somebody buying all these shares, no matter how much they bid. So that's why there's a set process. There's a methodology for how companies are taken over. It's called a tender offer. You know, say Walmart wanted to buy Target, which they're not going to do, folks. They're not going to do it. It's not going to happen. But let's say they had $30 billion lying around, and they wanted to buy Target. They would go to the New York Stock Exchange and say, you know, we're interested in taking over Target. We will pay $64 a share. See, they have to pay a 5, 10, 20% premium. Because they know as soon as they started buying up all the shares, the price would start to skyrocket. So there's a set methodology. And then it's announced that there is a tender offer for Target at $64 a share by Walmart. Now, it's not going to happen. Don't, you know, that's not a good example because it would never be allowed. And plus, Walmart doesn't want Target. But it would never be allowed because they're competitors, and it would be too much concentration. It's already too much concentration in retail. We'll go there in another discussion. But that's how it would work. They would say, we want a tender offer. We'll offer you 10% more. And then the market will respond immediately. Investors will believe, yeah, this is a bona fide offer, meaning a real offer, and the price will jump to that $64. Or they'll say, they're just blowing smoke, they don't really mean it, and the price won't go up. And sometimes the price will go more than that. Why? Because they expect somebody else to try to outbid them. Yeah, it gets pretty gnarly, it gets pretty scary, gnarly as the surfers would say. It can get pretty scary because there's people bidding and outbidding others, and if you own this shares, that's great. You know, you're gonna, they're gonna take it away from you at a premium. Maybe you're not happy about that because you didn't really want to sell, but too late. If they own 50% plus one, they can say, okay, we're taking the company, we're buying the company. Slide number 85. How we doing? Not bad. AT&T and Verizon. You've heard of these two little mom and pop, the duopoly. T-Mobile, Sprint are pretty small compared to these two guys. And so you look at the price of AT&T, $35.50, $46 for Verizon. You think Verizon's bigger than AT&T? No. Look at the number of shares. There are 6.5 billion shares of AT&T, a little over 4 billion of Verizon. So it turns out that AT&T is bigger than Verizon. Not that much bigger, but they're both huge companies. $218.5 billion, $188 billion. They are both mega cap stocks. So now, you're going to look at the price, right? But you're also going to look at the market cap, because you are Business 123, Introduction to Investment Students, and you need to do this. Cool. All right. And that's one of the things I ask you to look up. You don't have to calculate it. You could. It's on all the major financial websites. You just look it up. Okay, so now let's take a few moments we're down. we're in the home stretch here, folks. Stretch, wake up, maybe pause and come back to this later. We're ready to do investment strategies. And I'm going to tip my hat. I'm going to tell you right off the bat that I think buy and hold is really the only strategy for the vast majority of us folks. You use fundamental analysis. What's that? We'll discuss that in detail. Basically, analyzing the company itself to identify high-quality companies with good growth prospects and value and potential for dividends at reasonable prices. We don't want to overpay. It's very boring, but it works. Sometimes people call it value investing, but be careful. Remember our discussion of growth versus value. And then you'll hear people call it GARP, which I love. It's a great book, folks. Read the book, the movie. The book is always better, almost. Growth at a reasonable price. We want growth, but we don't want to spend an outrageous amount of money for it. Mr. Buffett is a buy and hold investor, and he was once asked, well, Mr. Buffett, how long should you hold on to a company? And, of course, he's a bit of a curmudgeon, and he said, hold it forever! Well, he's being a little facetious because you don't live forever. But the idea is, if you owned a pizza shop or a shoe shop or whatever, a service center for cars or garage, and it was doing well, would you just sell it because the value went up 10%? No, you'd hang on to it. If the company's doing well, you hold it. In fact, you might sell it later when you're ready to retire or bequeath it to your family or whatever. But the idea is you're buying a business, hold on. And there's a wonderful example on the website. Now, this is in the face-to-face class. We would show you the don't lose perspective. So you're going to do that on your own. There's a little presentation, a commentary that shows you the don't lose perspective example. And I'll tell you, it's not that hard to understand. If you try to guess what's going to happen next month or next week or whatever, next 3 months, you're going to drive yourself insane. Because first of all, you're not going to be successful. Your emotions are going to take over, and you're going to give yourself ulcers. You're going to quit. You're going to say, I'll never trust these bums again. Because in the short term, it's very random. But if we then just simply extend our time horizon, we find that it's not as scary as it seems. Ignore the day-to-day, the month-to-month machinations and jumping up and down, and just realize that it's a long-term investment. But I've already told you this, I'm going to tell you this again, but I can't emphasize it enough, folks. If you're in it for the short term, good luck. I can't help you other than to explain to you that you're in for a rocky ride and you probably are going to lose a lot of money because emotions are going to take over, and emotions are our enemies. If we allow our emotions to take over, we're almost always going to make a bad decision. Slide 87, the income strategy. Well, this is a form of buy and hold, really. Sometimes called equity income. Remember the equity income mutual funds from Chapter 4? We emphasize dividends over capital appreciation. Ideally, we're looking for companies that have been growing their dividends. And we've made the, I think we've made the description that companies that pay consistently growing dividends tend to do well when the market as a whole does poorly, because dividends are always a positive. Dividends don't lie. In general, these are appropriate for conservative stock investors. Again, we're not talking about politics. We're talking about people who are willing to invest in stocks, realize that there's going to be up and downs, but don't want the roller coaster. This strategy works great with DRIPs. Remember the dividend reinvestment plans? Stocks which have had histories of consistent dividend increases have often been the market's best long-term investments. Yes, they have. Yes, they have. Yeah, you go back and look at them. Sure, it's wonderful to watch a GoPro or a Tesla skyrocket into the atmosphere, Netflix and Amazon, but companies that have been around for decades and have paid consistently growing dividends, Philip Morris cigarettes, Procter & Gamble, Pampers, diapers, Tide, who else? 3M, Post-it Notes, ExxonMobil, the oil companies. Be careful, they're more cyclical, oil materials, but still, ExxonMobil. These are companies, GE, they have done very well for themselves and very well for their investors. Now, the growth strategy. Sure, everybody wants to jump on the bandwagon. The stars in the sky are bright. The stock price is bid up to very high levels. And typically these are the stocks of the very riskiest. When the slightest hint of the slowdown in the growth appears, the stock price is often brutally punished. So go ahead, invest in some growth stocks, folks, but remember, it's going to be a bumpy ride. These are companies that are growing their companies. The dividends are not important. Why? Because they need that money to reinvest back in the company. High price to earnings ratio in expectation of higher earnings in the future. And so we want a little bit of growth, yes, but we realize that we're going to be in for a bumpy ride. And then slide 89 takes it one step further. The aggressive growth strategy. And if we read at the bottom, this is the strategy that many people think they're supposed to use when they start investing in stocks. They see professional traders with four computer screens and they're buying and selling all day long. Folks, forget it. It ain't gonna work for you. It is fraught with perils and drawbacks, not the least of which are the serious transaction costs that can be generated and taxes as a result of frequent trading. Stockbrokers, if you're a stockbroker, you simply adore you simply adore traders, speculators who use this strategy. So, you know, people will say, well, it's sour grapes because he can't do it. I'm not trying to badmouth people who do this for a living. Some of them are quite good, as we saw in chapter one. But so some people are very good at hitting a fastball at 98 miles an hour. Some people can sing a four hour opera. Some people can, you know, cut out an appendix without leaving so much as a quarter inch scar. But that's not the average person on the streets, and we're the average person on the streets. Now, if you want to do this, don't let me stop you. Go get 'em, Tiger, and I wish you the best of luck and success, and I want to hear how you're doing, certainly. But that's the exception, not the norm. So we call this the speculation investor, the speculative investor, which is an oxymoron because we should never include speculation and investing in the same sentence. It just shouldn't happen. Short-term trading. The investor aggressively trades in and out of stocks in order to achieve eye-catching returns. Instead of waiting 3 to 5 years, and why do we keep using this term? We'll see when we get to Chapter 6. For a stock to move, an aggressive stock trader would go after the same investment return in 3 or 6 months or 3 weeks. Some traders have time horizons in days, but we said there are companies that are using computers to make millions of trades per day. Are you going to fight them, folks, with your click, click, click? I don't think so. So I hope I have sufficiently scared you away, but if you still want to do it, best of luck and success to you, and tell us how it all worked out. Yeah. I'll tell you about one student we had, and he is very sharp, folks, and he wants to go. He's looking to eventually make his way on Wall Street, and he does this. And he's been successful, and he's also gotten hammered, and he admitted to the entire class at the very end of the semester that he had been wiped out four times. Four times! I mean, I can't even imagine once being wiped out, going to my wife, "Dear, do you remember that retirement account we used to have?" "What do you mean, we used to have?" He went through this losing everything four times, but he's still standing. He's getting back up, and he's done actually. He tells me he's done very well, even though losing everything. Well, probably not. We're not talking about a lot of money, probably, because he's young. So I wish him the best of success, and I want to hear all the wonderful things that happen to him when he makes it to Wall Street and is trading for Merrill Stench or Morgan Stupid or one of the other firms. I'm sorry, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, right, when he's trading for one of the international global firms and making tons of money and he has his own private jet and maybe he starts his own hedge fund. But it ain't for the vast majority of us. Slide 90, contrarian. Now, here's something that's actually pretty powerful, folks, contrarian investing. You invest in stocks that are out of favor with the market for some reason, as reflected by low price to earnings ratio, low prices compared to their fundamentals, the analysis that we'll do in the next few chapters. Contrarian investors actively seek stocks from companies with sound financial statements from the market that the market is undervalued. So in other words, you're trying to be a salmon. You're going against the stream. You're going against the vast majority of investors. And one famous investor, contrarian, said, "I always try to be accommodating. I buy when others want to sell, and I sell when others want to buy." Now, it's a difficult thing to do. Why? Because historically the market rises about three times as much as it falls. So if you continue to sell as the price goes up, you're eventually not going to have anything. And so Howard Marks, who's the CEO of Oak Tree Capital, a very famous contrarian, was asked, "Well, what is it like to be a contrarian?" And he said it very simply. It's not a steady business. Sometimes you have to just be willing to sit on your hands and wait until disaster strikes. And then you swoop in. Well, one very famous contrarian investor, Mr. Warren Buffett, who we have mentioned several times, and you should read about him and read his biography, autobiography. No, it's not autobiography. It's a biography called Snowball. It's actually very good. When the markets crashed in 2008, he swooped in and bought $5 billion of Goldman Sachs and maybe $3 billion, or is it $5 billion of, I can't remember exactly which, $3 billion of GE. And then later on, he bought $10 billion of Bank of America. And he wrote an op-ed piece in the opinion piece in the New York Times saying, "I'm buying, I'm bullish on America, I don't think we're going to go down the porcelain oasis." And he was right. All three of those trades became very, very profitable for him. So contrarian investing is something you should look up, but it ain't easy to do. It's not easy to do. Slide 91. Now here are three strategies that I hope you will just stay away from, folks. Just don't even get involved in these. Sector rotation, momentum investing, and market timing. Sector rotation says, look, I will look at the various sectors of the economy, energy, healthcare, and there are various sectors of healthcare, wireless communications, cruise, leisure, cruise lines, materials, and I will buy these sector funds, or maybe buy individual stocks in those sectors that are hot, and I'll sell the sectors when they become stale. Well, good luck, right? You are waiting on this sector to become hot, and it's sort of sitting around, and then you go jump to the sector that is hot just in time for that one to go stale and yours to become hot. So good luck. Momentum investing, we've already made some mention of this. These are people that do aggressive trading. It's similar to the aggressive growth strategy. You buy stocks as they go up, sell stocks as they go down, often involving selling stocks short, meaning you're hoping they go down, it uses the greater fool theory. The greater fool theory? Yes. Somewhere out there is a greater fool than I. than I am. Somewhere out there is a greater fool who will buy even higher. And this is what happened 10 years ago real estate market. Prices of houses just kept going higher and higher and higher, and the momentum was driving them even higher. So go ahead, buy one, because somebody out there will buy your house no matter what price you buy it at. Housing prices will always continue to go up. Yeah, okay. So, you can see the problem with this one. And then market timing. These are people who will tell you, yes, look at our system. Our system in the last 30 years has always predicted that when the market was going to fall, when the market was going to go up. Dear students, they backdate those systems to work. Will they work in the future? Maybe, maybe not. Probably not. Definitely not. So don't listen to people. Sometimes they're fooling themselves, folks. Really, I ran across one guy who had this one system that he was so sure was going to work. He showed you how it worked in the past, but I said, you backdated it. Yes, but it's going to work in the future. Why do you think it's going to work in the future? Because it's worked in the past. And then I never knew what happened to the guy. But I just said, good luck. This is a great comment from a very famous investor from the mid-20th century, Bernard Baruch. Don't try to buy at the bottom and sell at the top. It can't be done, except by liars. In other words, they're either trying to fool you, or they're fooling themselves, or both. So all three of these strategies, I hope you will stay away from. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't learn about them, because this is an introduction to investments class, so you can speak about them to your friends and family who may be trying them. They hear about this market timing, and they can't wait to get involved and lose their money. So, slide number 92. Which strategy do you favor? I should really just take this slide away, because I've already tipped my hat, and you're probably going to say, well, I'm going to be a buy and hold investor like Mr. Piano. And that's what I don't want you to do, but I do want you to do in this. And normally I don't want you to follow me just because I do it, but in this case I do want you to follow me because it is very difficult to be an aggressive growth, to be a contrarian, to be a momentum investor. It doesn't mean you shouldn't try. It doesn't mean you shouldn't. It doesn't speak to you. But I like buy and hold. Income strategy is another good. It's basically a form of buy and hold. And contrarian, it sounds great in theory, but it's awful hard to buy when everyone else is selling. Everybody else is running one way. What do? You run that way too. Why? Because you're a human. And 100,000 years ago, when everybody was running that way, you ran that way. And the people who stood there and said, look at all those people running over those were the people who got eaten by the tiger. And it's in our genes. We can't help ourselves. That's why buy and hold and market falls, you just relax and think long term. Sound good? So, we are done. Wow. With our introduction to stocks, sums up from Chapter 5, mostly from the presentations. Make sure you understand what's in the presentations. Listen to them again. Read them again. Study the study guides. Be awesome, because, dear students, you are ready to be introduced to the temple of common stock valuations. When we come back in our next chapter, dear students, you will be introduced to techniques that much of the world doesn't even know exists. Will it make you a successful investor? I hope so. But it's not a guarantee. I hope it will tilt the odds in your favor so that you will become a successful, long-term, prudent investor and build wealth slowly over time. I know, it sounds like an advertisement. I apologize. But thank you so much. We want to thank you all the time, but realize that everyone at Southwestern is always incredibly proud, grateful, honored, happy that you are with us, and we want this to be the best class you've ever taken. you have ever taken and will help you in this adventure that we call life. Be awesome. Bring honor and glory to Southwestern Community College. Study hard, and we'll see you in our next chapter, Common Stock Valuations.